You are entering the Royals Podcast Network.
A show that looks at Kansas City baseball's past, present, and future.
Belted to left field. Billy comes through tonight. Splash!
This is the Kansas City Baseball Vault.
And welcome into the Kansas City Baseball Vault. And we have a special show for you today, if for no other reason than when we are recording this, it is opening day, even though it's mostly over because the Royals had finished playing. And we found out that they will not be going 162-0 for the 45th consecutive year. So that record is safe. But we have real, legitimate, actual games to talk about. Before we get to that, you'll notice that I am once again not Troy Olson. I'm Jeff Furr. I'm hosting today. Troy had some family things he had to take care of, so he won't be hosting today. But he said he'd hopefully be back next week if things kind of settle down for him. When he's basically, ever since he's moved to Albuquerque, things have been going kind of crazy for him. Not necessarily in a bad way, just busy and getting married and all that good stuff. So, but thankfully, I'm joined by the... I don't even have a correct superlative for Michael Engel. So, how are you tonight?
I'm pretty good. It's a Monday, and I don't like Mondays.
It is a Monday.
And the Royals lost, and I don't like losing. And I'm kind of tired and grumpy, but.
And then Twitter got weird, and it was just.
Yeah, just the floodgates, and just, you know, other. Illusions and whatever. Yeah, so it's been a weird day.
It has been a weird day, but we can talk about one of the I guess you could call it bittersweet, a bright point that, hey, we've got real legitimate Royals baseball. James Shields is on the mound. We've got good things to talk about because it's live baseball. And then the bitter part of that is, well, yeah, that's great, but they lost today. So we'll start there. We'll start talking about the game. James Shields took on Justin Verlander in a battle of two of the best pitchers in the American League. And I mean, I don't know if it would. I guess I thought James Shields. I didn't watch the game. I had to follow along at work on my phone. But judging from, you know, what I could see on my phone and what I saw on Twitter, it seemed like James Shields pitched pretty well. Wasn't missing a ton of bats, but, you know, was getting the job done effectively. And then Justin Verlander got off to a bit of a rocky start, and then he kind of settled. Or he got off to a good start and then kind of hit a rough patch and then kind of settled back in. And then the bullpens came in, and, well, we'll get to that in a second. But
yeah.
for James, did you watch the game, Mike?
No, I was at work, so I was on the radio listening to, you know, what was going on. So I was able to follow a bit, and then when I went to lunch, it was actually on one of the TVs, so I was able to watch about an inning of the game. And actually, it was the one inning where the Royals scored some runs, so I was able to see a little bit, but it was like an inning and a half. And actually, when things started to go south, I was actually having my annual review, so... I missed that too, so I guess I'll shoulder the loss, or my boss will shoulder the loss for
damn right he will.
Take me away from it, because they scored while I was watching the game, and then I had to go back to work, and then when I leave to go get the review done is when they give up the tying runs. So, ugh. I mean, I'm no mathematician, but you know, you read the signs and do the math, and you know.
There it is.
It's pretty obvious, you know.
So from the little bit you saw and listening to the radio, you probably had a little bit more of a feel for it than I did. I mean, how do you think James Shields pitched in the old season opener here?
Well, he was going pretty well. I mean, through six innings, he'd given up one homer.
That was in like second inning?
Second inning, yeah. And then Martinez almost took him deep again, but it went foul. So, you know, two mistakes there, even though one was a long strike. But other than that, I mean, he hadn't walked anybody in the first six innings, and he gave up only four hits. So, you know, he had been doing pretty well. And then, you know, comes out for the seventh inning. Some people were okay with that. Some people were not. from what I saw, at least on Twitter. And he, you know, he gave up, got one out and gave up a triple, walked a guy, and then that's kind of where he left it and handed it over the bullpen. So, but for the most part, I mean, he pitched pretty well. He was in one tight spot and got a favorable call against Austin Jackson on a full count. Pitch was a little outside, but it was a called third strike. And then he struck out, Alex Avila. So he kind of got out of a situation where Tigers had a runner on third with one out, and he was able to get away from it. So, you know, he pitched pretty well. He had a couple of 1-2-3 innings. One of those was an 8-pitch inning. So he was doing okay. I mean, he looked pretty much like James Shields is going to look, and just kind of was unfortunate that the bullpen wasn't able to hold a lead for him.
Yeah, and before we'll put a pin in that, because before we get to that, we can talk about the offensive performance, which was mostly lackluster, except for the dominance of he whose name I am not even worthy to mention, but we'll do anyway, Salvador Perez. The dude goes 4-for-4. I believe 3 of those hits were off of Verlander, including 2 doubles.
Yeah.
So had the first RBI of the game, I believe, and scored a run himself. So, I mean, Salvador Perez, it's early, obviously, but, I mean, anytime you can come out as a 23-year-old player and go 4-for-4 on a day when Justin Verlander starts a game, I mean, you're looking, you know, that's pretty good. That's impressive. So that was a bright spot. Maybe the lone bright spot, though. Hosmer hit a double in the first inning, I believe, and then was stranded. But I think that was his only hit of the game.
Yeah.
Billy Butler got a hit. But, I mean, there was pretty much nothing else going on there for the majority of the rest of the game. Lorenzo Cain had an RBI to knock in Sal Perez when he was out off of one of his doubles. But, I mean, overall, the brief glimpses that you saw offensively, they looked like they were still kind of getting back in the swing of things, or was it kind of typical Royals? Like, I mean, who did you see at the plate when you were watching?
Well, I saw it was that fourth inning where the Royals scored 3 runs and Butler led off. I think he grounded out. And then Alex Gordon worked a walk, pretty good at bat. Perez doubled him home. And then Mike Moustakas, I think he flew out. I'm not looking at the play-by-play, so I'm trying to recreate. No, Moustakas hit a little dribbler, and it was enough to move Perez to third, which allowed him to score on the single by Kane. And then Alcides Escobar works a walk, amazingly. Who would figure that he would work a walk off Justin Verlander? So he goes there. Nori Aoki reached on an error, which is just something he does. And then Omar Infante walked with the bases loaded. So, I mean, they batted around on him. And, Hosmer flew out to end the rally with Stranden and the bases loaded. So, but that was all they really did. I mean, other than Perez, who went 4-for-4, the Royals only got 3 other hits. And they didn't get any other walks other than that one inning. So, there was, I think, one hit. Butler got a hit off of a reliever, maybe. I mean, that's it. I mean, that's all they really did all day. Or Perez got the hit off Al Albuquerque. So they didn't hit the bullpen. It was kind of strange to see that the Tigers bullpen was the stout one and the Royals bullpen fell apart. So, but from the inning that I saw, they looked great. But it was the only inning that I saw. And, they were 1-for-9 with runners in scoring position. And they left a lot of guys on base with 2 outs. And, that's easy to do against Verlander because, you know, he's an elite pitcher. But it's also a big sign of, you know, why they lost. I mean, last year, you look at the record, they were very good with whenever they would score 4 runs or more. Today, they only scored 3 runs and they lost. And, you know, that's usually going to be the case for a big league team. If you don't score 4 runs, you're probably not going to win. And today they had that one inning and that was it.
Yeah. You know, it was offensively, it seemed pretty disappointing, but now we can roll into that bullpen, which was ultimately the most disappointing. I mean,
yeah.
Here we are coming into a season where the Royals have their biggest strength across the board, everyone would say, is the bullpen, just loaded with top-level talent. They had one of the best ERAs and the best bullpen ERAs in the league last year, contributed to having one of the best pitching staff ERAs in the league last year. And they come out and just, you know, they just kind of laid an egg. And it started with Aaron Crow, who came in after Shields gave up the triple and the walk, so runners at the corners, and then he allowed both of them to score, which tied up the game. And then Wade Davis came and pitched an inning and an out, I believe, and was able to, you know, not take any damage, and then gets a couple runners on, and then Greg Holland tries to come in and clean up the mess in the bottom of the ninth and gives up the walk-off. So, you know, it was just kind of just – you didn't expect that coming out of the gate right there. You'd think, okay – the Royals can get into the seventh inning with a 3-1 lead, which they did. You'd think this game over, you know, just shut them down. And that is not what happened. So, let's temper everything now, because we obviously will preach it for the first probably 2 months on this show, not to jump the gun on anything. I mean, not to get that ahead of ourselves. Just one game, but you know, all the same, I mean, you weren't expecting something like that, were you?
No, I mean, the bullpen looked a little rough if you look at their spring numbers, and you can't really expect them to do what they did last year where they were just, you know, top to bottom. Everybody was pretty much dominant for most of the season, or at least long stretches of it. And so you don't come in thinking that that's going to be the downfall on opening day, that you're going to run into a situation where you bring in guys who, you know, Aaron Crow's a guy, he's played, you know, since 2011, he's been a regular part of the bullpen, and he's been pretty solid
all-star.
For the most part. Yeah, all-star Aaron Crow. And, you know, you figure he's going to be okay, but at the same time, you know, Wade Davis has his track record as a reliever. Greg Holland was, you know, the best reliever in the American League last year, and it just didn't work. I mean, you know, I think that there is some question of, you know, who was brought in and when by Ned Yost in some of these situations. You're not going to see Aaron Crow, you know, have that kind of a problem all the time. Wade Davis isn't, you know, he had one perfect inning and then he came back out and wasn't able to contain it. So I don't think those are going to be normal things that you're going to see, but it is disappointing to see, you know, all the problems kind of come out right away and this early. And yeah, I mean, it's just, you know, like you said, it's one game, and you know, one game today you know, counts technically the same as one game in August, even though, you know, the context is completely changed. So I mean, it could be something where if the Royals are at 89 wins in September, you know, this one might hurt quite a bit, but you know, every team's going to lose games. So you can't really, you know, it's like Sam Mellinger said at you know, different points last year, you know, sometimes it's like every win is a parade and every loss is the meltdown, and you can't melt down on every game just because there's 162 of these.
Yeah. And it's like that, sorry to interrupt, but that scene in Major League 2 where Rube Baker or whatever, the catcher gets all excited. He's a young guy after, you know, the first hit of the first game of the season, and Jake Taylor comes over and says, "Settle down, kid. We got 162 more of these to go." So it's that kind of a thing.
Yeah, it's like how much energy can you really expend on just one game and pour it over and tear it apart? I mean, Dave Lesky said on Twitter, you know, if this was a May 23rd game, which that might be the same date as the James Shields game last year against the White Sox. I don't know. I wonder if he chose that.
Lesky's sneaky enough to actually do that on purpose.
Maybe I have the date wrong, though. Maybe, I don't know. But it's not important anyway. But, I mean, why get worked up over it? I understand losing sucks, and that if it does come down to, okay, the Royals are one game out, yeah, it is a game that, you know, it matters. But at the same time, there's going to be other games where the Royals, have much worse problems than what happened in this game. And, you know, would be far better examples for, you know, what you could look to turn around. So I'm trying to like keep that as my approach, just because, you know, otherwise, my goodness, it's going to be how many swings can you go through in a season if you're going to get worked up over every single thing? So I think it's definitely heightened because it is opening day. I have an alternate theory that, you know, baseball pops up right after March Madness, right after the Super Bowl, right after college football bowl season, where one game means so much that it's almost like people get primed. And then when you put opening day on this big stage, then it's, you know, it seems like it's a bigger game when really it could be in 3 weeks that you're not even, you know, remembering this game or worrying that much about this game because there have been so many others that have popped up since. So, you know, there's perspective that you got to have.
And it's kind of the good and the bad of baseball, you know. The good part is you lose, you got a game coming the next day, you can get right back on the horse. Well, I guess technically in this scenario, you don't. It's 2 days, they're off tomorrow, right?
Yeah.
So 2 days. But most of the time, it's the next day. But the bad part is, hey, you just lost, you got a game the next day. So, I mean, it's kind of nice. It's nice to have that, be able to put it behind you. But that's why so often in baseball, you can find, especially the Royals, can find themselves mired in these just losing streaks, because it's, when you don't have a break, it's tough to kind of shake yourself out of it. And that's kind of the feeling that, I mean, I'm trying to be just like you and keep that perspective and everything, because it's one game, not going to get too worked up. But in the back of my head, just like every Royals fan probably, you see that thing like, oh, God, here we go. You know, it's not just like it's the here we go again thing, but it's, you know, we said on this show, you come in, you say, okay, what has to happen for the Royals to be successful this year? Well, the bullpen has to be nearly as good as they were last year, and the offense has to take a step forward. You know, Infante, Aoki have to be worth what, you know, worth all the quote-unquote the hype, you know, whatever the hype was for those two, they need to be worth it. And, you know, players like Lorenzo Cain, Moustakas need to go forward and all that. Well, you know, then you look at this game, it's like, okay, well, they came in, the bullpen blew it, and the offense stunk, and, you know, they lose the game. So it doesn't mean anything, but at the same time, you get that feeling where it's kind of, is this going to be the same old story? And you just, you know, that's never fun.
Yeah. I mean, here's one way to look at it. If a baseball team wins 4 out of every 7 games over 162 games, that's 92 wins. It's just, you get that one extra win every week. That's what you look for. So maybe this is the one extra for Detroit, or maybe, you know, this is just one of the three that you lose. I mean, it's such a long-term game that those little things make such a big difference. I mean, you look at Sal Perez 4-for-4 day. I mean, you know, come June, that's not going to be that big of an influence on his batting average. No. Just because he went 4-for-4. I mean, it's going to be, you know, you get so many extra at-bats, it's going to blend in with everything else. So, I mean, drawing conclusions from one game is just not, it's just, you can't do it. I mean, you just can't. I mean, you can bookmark it and keep an eye on it. I mean, you look at Aaron Crow, brought in one of the arguments at the time, and I think Ross Martin, PC Bearcat on Twitter, pointed out that Aaron Crow was a below average guy with runners on base, or at least allowing inherited runners to score last year. And that's true. And he pointed that out before Aaron Crow, you know, threw a pitch. So, you know, you can question that kind of decision and kind of keep it in mind down the line to see, okay, was Ned Yost continually, you know, making this decision, putting guys in this kind of spot. But I mean, it could just be that Aaron Crow the next 3 times out goes and strands runners, and this game only sticks out because he allowed them. So there's a lot going on, and it's, I mean, it's one of those things that you just kind of have to keep track of as a fan and keep in mind as you try to analyze what's happening out on the field and try to keep everything, you know, big picture rather than getting worked up over one game.
Yeah, and so, I mean, like you said, not too much we can go into about one game and shouldn't. So it was something to talk about, but now we're going to use that and take a break, and we're going to come back, and I'm going to get my dogs out of my room so that they stop making noises with their collars. And then we're going to come back, and we're going to talk about what we have, what our predictions are for the next 161 games of this long season. So we will see you on the other side.
Come to Spit Cup this week. We'll let the person who has the highest bar tab ride the bull. We don't have any TVs in our bar, but we make our own entertainment. Mondays, it's free cover charge to anybody with a gun rack in their pickup truck. Tuesdays, we've got $8 beer night. All domestic beers are on special for only $8. It's Spit Cup. Wednesdays is longest tobacco spit. Thursdays is foot fungus night. Friday night is jamboree night. Bring your crap kick in your 10-gallon hats. And this weekend, you get our world-famous Spit Cup girls. You get to pick which one has the most teeth. It's Spit Cup. No love letters, talking to the wall.
Or you could go to Kelly's Westport Inn. The highest quality drinks with the lowest prices. You know what we do. Drinks, friends, plenty of TV showing sports. They've got all the basketball and all the baseball on. Live music on the weekends. The best pizza in Kansas City and fun. Kelly's has the best rooftop patio in town and is voted one of the best places in Kansas City to check out the view, if you know what I mean, and maybe make a new friend. Make the best choice for your evening entertainment, Kelly's Westport Inn. Kelly's is at 500 Westport Road in Kansas City, Missouri. Kelly's Westport Inn. Tell them the Royal Man Report sent you. Somebody stands up and says we're sick of the controlling and the silver spoon that feeds all your stories and your bowling. Are you listening? Are you listening?
And welcome back into the Kansas City Baseball Vault. First, we before the break here, we kind of talked about the season opener game today as the Royals drop a heartbreaker to the Detroit Tigers 4-3. But as we were talking in the first segment, the best thing about baseball is it's a marathon, not a sprint. There's 162 games, which means after the Royals go 0-1, there's 161 more. And we've got a whole season to talk and discuss. And since we're at the beginning, we can tell you what us podcasting experts, prognosticator extraordinaires have in store this Royal season, because we spend so much of our own free time, we know so much about what we're talking about, that we're going to be exactly right, like always.
Exactly, which is why we'll probably have three different opinions.
yes, indeed. So first we can start by, we pretty much nailed it down before in a couple previous shows, but there were a couple spots that were still in question. So we'll go over the 25-man roster real quick and just show you their pitching staff. The Royals are going to battle this year with Francisco Bueno, Bruce Chinn, Tim Collins, Aaron Crow, Wade Davis, Jeremy Guthrie, Kelvin Herrera, Greg Holland, James Shield, Jason Vargas, and Yordano Ventura. Brett Hayes and Salvador Perez as catchers. Their infielders include Alcides Escobar, Eric Hosmer, Omar Infante, Mike Moustakas, Danny Valencia, and Pedro Siriaco. Outfielders Nori Aoki, Lorenzo Cain, Gerard Dyson, Alex Gordon, Justin Maxwell, and the designated hitter, the fan favorite, everybody's favorite player, Billy Butler. So I guess we can start here with not necessarily just the roster, but from those names, Mike, who jumps out at you? You know, are there any surprises that, I mean, we've kind of talked about it all through spring training, but for the final, we've started day one. with this roster? Are there any surprise names, and, you know, good or bad? Who do you, is there any really big breakouts you see? Any names that jump out at you, or you know, just kind of thoughts on the roster as a whole?
It's pretty interesting that all through the winter and all through spring training, the Royals were really pretty adamant about, you know, they were saying that they didn't think that having an 11-man pitching staff would be really feasible. And here they are, you know, their opening day roster has an 11-man pitching staff. Some of that just comes from, you know, Lou Kochaver was injured, you know, Tommy John surgery, Lewis Coleman got hurt, so he's on the DL for a little while. And it just kind of ended up working out that, okay, you know, that gives them the roster spot to play with, which was kind of the question all offseason about, you know, what are they going to do about middle infield, or at least after Emilio Bonifacio was designated for assignment. I mean, that was the question, you know, who are they going to have up the middle to back up Escobar and Infante and basically play that utility role? And so Coleman going on the DL allows Pedro Ciriaco to make the team. You know, keeps Danny Valencia on the team, and you know, with Infante and Escobar both at least healthy enough to, you know, start the year, you know, that kind of gives them a full bench to play with. Plus you've got, you know, Maxwell and Dyson to back up the outfielders. So there's not really a lot of surprises in any of these. I think Bueno is probably the biggest surprise, but you know, he's also a guy who pitched pretty well this spring, and he's at least his small sample size numbers look pretty good. And so, you know, considering that Donnie Joseph had some problems towards the end of spring training and Danny Duffy was kind of the next guy they would have thought to put in the bullpen and he had his troubles, you know, it doesn't really make a huge, you know, surprise to me to see this is the roster. We'll see kind of what they do once Lewis Coleman is able to return, which should be pretty soon. I think it's just something that they need to give him the rest to actually, you know, get through and feel better. I think it was like a bruised finger on his pitching hand. So you could see how that would be difficult to command a baseball if you're having that kind of issue. So no, not really any surprises. I think the thing that a lot of people are going to be paying attention to will be what Mike Moustakas does, because he had such a great spring. And, you know, after last year where he was just miserable, but also had a good spring, you know, I think people are going to be looking at that. And I'm interested to see kind of what he does. I think everybody's interested in Yordano Ventura. He looked great in spring training, so I think he's definitely a guy to keep an eye on. But a lot of these guys, you know, they're either veterans who've been established or they're, you know, guys who everybody kind of knows. So I don't know if there's a lot of surprises. It's just kind of like, okay, we know Eric Hosmer can be good. Does he make the leap this year? I kind of think he will. So I guess that would be kind of my breakout, that Eric Hosmer goes from being, you know, star to superstar, which is kind of what we expect, but we hadn't really seen quite yet. But to be a guy, you know, like Freddie Freeman type, who can go to all fields and hit, you know, 70 extra base hits a year and, you know, play good defense and hit for average and get on base and do all those things that you expect a franchise first baseman to do. So I guess I would go with that, but it's also, you know, I'm a first baseman fanboy anyway from way back, so maybe that's not fair for me to pick Hosmer. Maybe I'm biased.
Mike, I'm with you. There's no huge surprises on the roster, really. I mean, there were a couple like, oh, Francisco Bueno, that was an interesting route to go, but overall, nothing that shocks you or anything. Now, that said, I do think there are kind of a couple inflection points in the roster, if you will. A couple areas where you say, if this player just skyrockets or performs really, really well, then the Royals are going to be in good shape. And there's Eric Hosmer is one of those inflection points. If he takes that leap from star to superstar, mm-hmm. then Royals are going to be in good shape. They're going to look a lot better. You know, so I agree with you on that point. Yordano Ventura, obviously, when you've got the kind of electric stuff that he has, when you have that ability that he obviously has and showed in spring training, then, you know, he could be kind of that next big thing, hopefully. And if that happens, then he, I mean, if you think about it this way, the one thing that people, they kind of lamented the Santana for Vargas thing, but it ultimately ended up now with the emergence of Ventura in spring. Now you've got a situation where Ventura comes in, and if he can give you what Santana gave you last year, probably not as many innings, but if he can give you that production, then you've got James Shields, who's probably going to give you close to what he gave you last year. You've got Ventura, who can give you close to Santana, at least in terms of numbers, if not innings. And then Guthrie, who will probably give you what he gave last year. But then your bottom half, you throw Vargas in there, who's going to be much better than whoever the four and the five were last year, you know, when you're talking Chen and Davis. And then you're looking at, okay, now the staff actually looks a little bit better. So that's, I mean, there's a huge unknown there with Yordan Ventura, obviously. But I'm just saying, if that were to occur, then you're certainly looking at a possibility of that happening. And like your bold prediction last week, Mike, the Royals would not miss Irvin Santana in that scenario. So that's another inflection point. And then you look at Mike Moustakas, which is a big one. Obviously, he needs to take that step. There's no more, you know, oh, you really need 1,500 plate appearances to tell what kind of a guy, what kind of a player they're going to be. You know, there's no more excuses. There's just literally none. You're either, you know, you're going to crap or get off the pot. You're either a big league ball player, Mike Moustakas, or you're a replacement level player, and the Royals can move on during this season, and they should. If you prove that you are a 195 hitter, like you were last year for the majority of the year, and don't hit home runs like you're supposed to, play adequate to solid defense in the field, you're not giving a ton of value to this organization, and there's somebody who can probably give more. So, you know, it's put up or shut up time for Mike Moustakas. Now, if he does take that leap, I mean, I think the idea that Moustakas can take this leap to home run slugging superstar guy, that's out the window. That's just not there anymore. He's never going to be a superstar. You know, even if whatever people thought he could be, he won't ever reach that ceiling. I think that's pretty clear now. But I do think it's still possible that he can be a solid to pretty good major league everyday player. You know, he can be your guy who's going to, all the Royals need from Moustakas to play the defense he's already playing, and then hit 265 with a 330 on base percentage, 20 to 25 home runs, and the rest will take care of itself. If that's what Mike Moustakas can do, and do that consistently year in, year out, then he'll make a lot of money in this league and he'll be a very good player. So, but he needs to show that he can do that, because to this point, he has not shown anywhere close to that capability. I shouldn't say that, because in 2012, he was pretty much exactly that. I think he hit around the 265, 270 range. Or did he? No, he kind of dipped below, didn't he? He was,
it was
in like
still a little lower
range. But he hit the, you know, what did he have, 20-some home runs? Or was it just 20 that year? But regardless, you know, he was close.
20, yeah.
I mean, he was close to that type of player. And that's what he needs to be, with a little bit more consistency attached to it. And then I think finally, the one that nobody's really kind of talking about all that much is Lorenzo Cain. I mean, he showed today, he hit an RBI today in the season opener. And he's a guy who needs to stay on the field from a health standpoint. Has had lots of problems with that in the past. Not sure what exactly it is. The way he kind of plays the game, if you will, that's been mentioned, which that's kind of a nebulous thing for, we don't really know why he gets injured, but he just does.
Yeah.
You know, kind of that trainer speak, if you will. They apparently made some adjustments with how he plays. And I don't know what, I mean, this was kind of just a small thing you kind of heard tidbits about to try and help him stay on the field. Hopefully, I have no idea how these things kind of work. Typically, when you try and tweak how somebody plays, you either do one of two things. You either make it even more easy for them to get injured because they're thinking too much and they end up screwing something else up and it doesn't come natural, or they're just completely ineffective because what you changed actually loses what made them so successful in the first place. So hopefully neither of those happen. But what is important here is if he can be, I mean, he's got that Gold Glove caliber defense in center field. He probably won't ever win a Gold Glove just because center field is stacked, especially with someone like Mike Trout patrolling center field in the American League. But if he's out there playing that caliber of defense, you know, kind of manning the outfield, and then he can come in and get you some solid bats, maybe add a little pop in that 15-20 home run range. You know, get on base, do some things with his speed on base. He's not really, he doesn't seem to have base stealing speed because I don't know that he necessarily has a really quick acceleration, but his long strides mean that he's kind of a first to third guy, or, you know, he'll easily score on a single when he's on second base, things like that. And if he can stay, I mean, there was talk last year from Sam Ellinger wrote an article about it, if I remember, about him possibly being the Royals MVP about around midseason.
Mm-hmm.
Because he was performing so well, he was like a two-war player, you know. So if he can stay on the field and have that kind of success consistently, sustain that for a whole season, I mean, you're talking, I mean, he can be a really good player. No one's really talking about it because I think people kind of dismiss him because of the injuries. But if he can be a 265, 270 guy with a 15 to 20 home runs and another, you know, that 330 on base and play Gold Glove caliber defense in center field, I mean, that's a hell of a player, and no one's really even saying anything. And I think that that's well within the realm of possibility for what he can do, assuming he can stay on the field.
Yeah, and I remember going into last year, you know, Kane had played just, you know, 61 games in 2012. And, you know, in those 61 games, he'd hit seven homers. So it kind of seemed like a guy who could get into that 15 home run range over the course of a year. Last year, he didn't quite have that kind of power, you know, only hit four home runs. But, you know, I think you're right. If he can stay on the field, he can be extremely valuable. He's got the defense, and that's very clear. He'll steal enough bases, but you're right. He's never really been a base stealer. You know, he only has 171 professional stolen bases in his career. Still at a pretty decent rate, but not, you know, he's not Billy Hamilton. He's not Rajai Davis. He's not, you know, these guys who are specialists at stealing, you know, draw dice and that they get on base and do that. But he does have good game speed. And I think he's, you know, you're also right. He was the leader in wins above replacement at the All-Star break. And a lot of it was the defense, but he was, you know, doing enough. I think it was towards the end of the season he kind of tapered off as far as batting average and things like that. But, you know, he's a guy, he models his game after Torii Hunter. He looks like Torii Hunter when you watch him play. And Hunter is a guy who didn't really break out until he was about 27 years old as well. So, you know, Kane kind of fits that mold. It's you know, not too soon to, or it's too soon to give up on him. There's definitely a chance he could do something like having a breakout season, especially if he does stay healthy. And I think they've been working on flexibility and things like that. I, you know, I'm not a trainer, so I don't know, you know, any kind of biometric information I have is basically what I've read from various sources. Can't claim to be an expert, but, you know, it's at least stuff to look at. So I think you're right on there that he's a guy people do seem to kind of overlook him just because I think they just assume he's going to be injured. And so he's not going to be a factor. Going back to what you said about Mike Moustakas, there was an article that I saw in The Star by Andy McCullough where they were he was discussing the Royals' problems with pitching development. And what he started out with was this anecdote about Scott Sharp, you know, one of the key scouting directors in the organization, talking to John Lamb. And one of the things that he told John Lamb was, hey, we can't consider you a prospect anymore. You've got to have the performance to go out there and actually show us, you know, where you stand in the organization. And it's the same thing with Moustakas. I mean, he's got the name, you know, first round draft pick, you know, that's all there. But that's just background now. You know, you can't use that as a projection tool anymore because he has so many at-bats at the big league level that you have an idea of where he is, and you know that he's definitely a flawed player, but now it's about getting the most out of him. And maybe that's only, you know, a league average hitter with a little bit extra power who can play pretty good defense most of the time. It's going to be valuable, and it's going to, you know, keep him employed for a long time. It's not going to be, you know, the superstar that people saw, you know, giving him grades for best raw power in the organization, or, you know, the guy who was going to break Balboni's record or anything like that. So, you know, what the Royals are really kind of looking for is, you know, yeah, they just want him to be an average guy. And it's kind of like, you know, you look at going and getting Omar Infante and getting Nori Aoki. I mean, those guys are replacing Chris Getz and Jeff Francoeur. And so basically what you want to see is those guys come in, and even if they're league average, maybe they don't meet, you know, maybe Infante doesn't meet up with what his contract value would be, but it's still a significant upgrade over what they had. Now that's, you know, maybe it's not great, but it's at least better. And, you know, that's, you know, something that you kind of want to see. So if you have a lineup of average guys and three or four guys can really be very strong producers, you might be okay. So, you know, but that's asking a lot. And a lot of these guys haven't been average guys before, so they still have to go do it. And it's just like, you know, Moustakas, they've got to do it on the field. It's not all about promise anymore.
To your, sorry to keep jumping around, but to your Lorenzo Cain point, I just wanted to, looking up on Fangraphs here, in 115 games last year, Lorenzo Cain only hit .251 and a .348 slugging, but still had a 2.6 war, according to Fangraphs again. So, I mean, that's pretty solid considering those offensive numbers. So if you were able to stay on the field, call it 145, 150 games, and pick up those offensive numbers a little bit, I mean, that's an all-star caliber player.
Yeah, that could be just four or five wins.
Yeah, on paper, I mean, it's an all-star. He probably wouldn't make an all-star game, but it'd be one of those kind of – you'd start to see articles written about, you know, the most underrated player in the league and all that kind of stuff. But I think that's interesting, though, what you said about the McCullough article with Scott Sharp saying you need to prove, you know, that you're still a prospect to us. That's interesting because just judging from what we know, what we hear of the Royals, I don't know that you would normally think of them kind of – you kind of feel like they maybe –
It's awfully practical for this organization to jump there.
Yeah. And they've had kind of the sacred cow approach before, where if you're a top 20 prospect in baseball, then the Royals didn't question it. So it's kind of cool to see that or to hear that. And hopefully they've had that conversation with Moustakas. We talked about it on this show. I think that if they maybe identify that he's the kind of guy that you can't come out and say, hey, Mike, you've got to prove that you are our third baseman. I mean, we're not giving it to you this year. You've got to go out there and prove it. You know, maybe some people can't handle that, you know, right or wrong. They're professionals and they should be able to. I get it. But at the same time, the Royals as an organization have to understand when they do have a player like that, because they're out there. You know, so if they can identify that and they said, well, Mike Moustakas is not a guy who can handle that kind of criticism, that kind of an ultimatum, well, then it seems like the trip to Venezuela for winter league ball was kind of that more or less unspoken conversation of the same thing. To say, hey, you know, we're sending you down here because not just for fun, you know, not because we want to, but you need this extra practice because you need to take that next step. And, I mean, whether it's been up front, like the article you read and you were talking about with John Lamb, or kind of more passive, then regardless, I got to feel that message has been sent. And it'll be interesting to see how Mike Moustakas will respond this coming year. You know, I think we all agree that Eric Hosmer is fine. And not only that, but he'll probably continue to get better and take that next step. But Mike Moustakas is a big question mark in this organization. And I think they're putting a lot on him. So you know, of all those different inflection points I mentioned, he might be the biggest, because if he is what he was last year, then all of a sudden you've got the whole left side of your infield is basically one black hole offensively. And it's nice to have them out there defensively, but if they can't get you anything at the plate, how much value are you losing, you know, just by keeping them out there? And the Royals are going to hang their hats on that. You know, if things ever get tough this season, and they're going to say, oh, well, you know, they play such good defense and we're a defensive team and it's so important and all that. And yeah, okay, whatever. But at some point you got to produce. And we haven't really talked about Escobar that much, but that's kind of something too. This year might turn out to be a pretty big year for him, because if he has another 630 OPS year, then you start to wonder, is he really worth having out there? I mean, how good a defense does a player have to have to be good enough overall? I mean, what are your thoughts on that? Like, if you, let's kind of, there's something we haven't talked about that. This is an interesting topic, I think, with Escobar. I mean, what are your thoughts on his coming year?
If he gives you like what his career averages work out to be, I think it's, I think he'll be fine, because let me pull those up here. If I can, your computer will cooperate.
Here, let's see if I can pull it up here.
You're probably going to beat me to him.
Yeah, I'm already in Fangraphs. Okay, here we go. Yeah. So Escobar's career numbers, he's a 258 batting average, 295 on base, 342 slugging. So that's what, 637 OPS career.
Yeah, not great. Doesn't have a lot of power, but I mean, he's also shown that he can make pretty good contact most of the time, and he does add some by being able to steal some bases. But yeah, he's really got a hit. I mean, you look at what the Royals have on the farm; they've got guys like Orlando Calixte and Humberto Arteaga, and, you know, of course Raul Mondesi. You know, all guys who can play shortstop, and all guys who aren't terribly far. I mean, Mondesi is going to be in Wilmington this year. Arteaga and Calixte are going to be in at least Double A. I didn't see where they got assigned, but, you know, they're guys who have shown some promise and, you know, haven't really hit too many stumbling blocks. So, you know, it's not like they don't have the opportunity there to, you know, find a replacement for him, even if it's like a short term thing. I mean, you've got a guy like Jason Donald in the organization who might be able to handle it, or you might have, you know, somebody that you can just, you know, snag from anywhere else, you know, who's able to at least hit and play average defense. And then, you know, you're kind of looking at, you know, the viable replacement for Escobar, who, you know, really does, he's got to produce. I mean, he can't have another year like last year, but I don't think you can really expect a year like 2012, where he did hit really well. But a lot of it was based on, you know, actually going and, you know, a lot of balls in play. His on base was based almost completely on his batting average. You know, this year he's said that he wants to be more patient. The Royals want him to be more patient. And, you know, as long as he's able to, you know, kind of actually work on that and it results in better pitch selection, then that's great. And, you know, he gives you the defense, but, you know, if he's still hitting poorly like he was last year and getting on base only 25% of the time, well, I don't know what, you know, he's got to be pretty much perfect as a defender. And, you know, in Escobar's case, you know, the Royals team options start coming up in 2016. So he's got this year and next year really to show that he belongs at that shortstop spot. And if not, well, you know, maybe Mondesi will be ready by then and the Royals can make a break. It's, you know, it's not crazy to think that that might fit the timeline for Mondesi perfectly, where, you know, the Royals don't really have to stick with Escobar. And especially if he's not hitting, right there, you know, he's going to be starting to get older. Yeah. They could make a clean break from him and they have their replacement in house already. So, you know, the pressure's on him and he's got to hear those footsteps.
Yeah. I mean, just looking back at his four full years in the major leagues, he's had in 2010 with the Brewers, he had a let's see, well, I lost my place here. In 2010 with the Brewers, he had a 614 OPS. In 2011 with the Royals, it was a 633. In 2012, his best season was a 721. And then in 2013, he had a 559 OPS. I mean, gross. That is atrocious. That is bad. So, I mean, he's got to put up a 700 OPS to really – I mean, if you're dipping – I don't know. I mean, you might be able to convince me that I could live with Escobar's defense if he was hitting a 680, you know, 680 or above OPS, maybe. Probably not, but I'd listen to that argument. But
as long as you're batting him ninth.
Yeah, exactly.
And not second.
Right. But to me, he's got to be putting up a 700 OPS. You know, wherever that's coming from. If that means he's hitting a 340 on base and only a 360 slugging, I'm fine. You know, okay. It doesn't matter to me. But he's got to be putting up somewhere in that range to justify having him out there. Because even as good as he is defensively, I mean, he still has some issues out there. Like, he makes those spectacular plays, and then every once in a while, he just misses those kind of routine ones. And that was the line on him coming from Milwaukee, is that he just kind of spaces out and misses these random plays. And, you know, he's still better than the majority of the shortstops in the American League out there, and Major League Baseball in general. I mean, he's one of the tops defensively. But that'll only get you so far. And it's kind of make or break year for him as well. So, I mean, Moustakas, Lorenzo Cain, and Alcides Escobar are all – the Royals have kind of put their eggs in those baskets, and they need them to come through. And these are big years for those three players. And if they don't, then, I mean, you're looking at – let's say Lorenzo Cain is hurt, and he only plays 40 games this year. Mike Moustakas is hovering around the 200 line. Escobar strikes out 20% of the time, and he's, you know, his OPS is below 600. Then you've got three gigantic holes on your lineup. I guess that would be assuming that whoever they got in center field would be a hole. And this thing could go south really quick. And that being the case, then you're looking at, okay, Yost could lose his job, Dayton Moore could lose his job. I mean, that could torpedo this season real fast. So the Royals are putting a lot on these three players. And if they – it's not just those three players that have to worry about themselves if they don't perform. It's a lot of people in this organization that are going to have to worry about a lot of things if they don't perform, because that could be kind of the one thing that really undermines any success the Royals try and have this year.
Yeah, I think that's why they were really high on keeping Justin Maxwell, and they were really big on keeping Gerard Dyson, and why they went out and got Valencia is just to get backup plans for those areas. But they also have to, you know, if Kane doesn't work out, they also have Nori Aoki is going to be free agent next year. And, you know, Alex Gordon's option years are coming up, you know, his team options. So, you know, there could be some reconstruction. I mean, any of those guys could very likely not be in the outfield in 2 years. Or I think it's for Gordon, I think 2016 is his first option year, or the last year that's an option year. So yeah, I mean, they've got to keep that in mind too. I mean, if Kane just isn't the guy, even, you know, short term to get him through that point, if that's when it, you know, what it takes to wait on Bubba Starling, then, you know, they have to have something in mind there. So they do have to pin the hopes on him and, you know, Escobar and Moustakas. And you've seen it before, you know, what can happen when a 30-year lineup is just an automatic out. I mean, we saw it last May, saw a lot of it in 2012, where you would get to those points where you've got, in 2012, you would have Humberto Quintero, and then you'd have Chris Getz, and you'd have Alcides Escobar, and they'd be all hitting in a row, and, you know, you might as well just take the field again, because those guys aren't going to get on base for you. So, or maybe it would have been even draw Dyson, whoever. But, you know, that bottom of the lineup where it's just like this dark hole where you can't expect anything. And that can't happen again. You know, at least one of those guys has to be average, and, you know, Kane has to be on the field, and Escobar just has to be not miserable. I mean, he was just terrible last year. If he can be, you know, in that 80 OPS plus range, it's not great, it's not ideal, but it's at least better. And so I mean, there's a lot riding on those guys.
Yeah, so with that, we'll take this into our kind of final predictions for the year. We'll start with our records, and since Troy's not here, Troy sent us an email today to let us know kind of some predictions he made. I guess one of the things you could say is his bold prediction that would have fit with Mike and I's from last week. But his bold prediction was that, if I remember this, correct me if I'm wrong, Mike, but wasn't it that Yordano Ventura will be the best pitcher on the staff?
Yes. Right? Best starter on the team, yeah.
Best starter on the team. That's Troy Olsen's bold prediction for the Royals this year in terms of players. And then he predicted the Royals would have 89 wins this year, which comes to an 89-73 record and would be their best since 1989, I believe. I think that would match the 89 record.
There were 92 and 70
in
89. Okay. It was a painful year because
that year, then 89 wins. for me, I'm not quite as bullish on the Royals as a whole. Ventura, I like a lot, obviously, but just from the team perspective, I'm going to go. I predicted them to win 85 games last year, and I'm going to stick with that this year. You know, I've kind of had the argument or made the argument that while the loss of Santana and so on makes it seem really bad, like the Royals are going to take a step back, in actuality, when you think about Santana and Davis as a starter, and Getz and Francoeur for half the season, and replace all that with Vargas, Ventura, Aoki, and Infante, then the difference is pretty minimal. And the question becomes, well, can Ventura take that leap, so on and so forth? Well, I think it all kind of evens out, and they end up about the same as they were last year. Really competitive, kind of in it till the end, if you will, but just a few games shy. I'm going to predict 85 wins again this year. 85-77, excuse me, is what I got. Mike, lay it on us. What do you got?
Well, I have them doing exactly what they did last year and finishing 86-76. And
that's bold, Mike.
Yeah, I know, right? But I think I see it in a lot of the same ways, in that, you know, they did get better on offense, at least on paper. And if you look at them on paper as a pitching staff, I mean, you do have to kind of expect some regression from the bullpen, and you do have to kind of figure that, you know, without Santana, they do have to fill in those innings somewhere. And is Vargas going to be able to do that, or Ventura? So there's questions in that. You know, so I think it's something where they score more runs, but they allow more. And as a result, you know, they kind of break even. But I don't know. I mean, I think there's also a lot of scenarios, and we've talked about some of them, where things can go terribly wrong. And it could end up being something where they are just, you know, back to trying to be 500. You know, it's definitely possible. And, you know, it's kind of the worst fear. And they could be even worse than that. I mean, there's a good article by Rainey today on his blog, kind of talking about standard deviations and things like that, and pretty interesting. And he detailed a lot of the things that could go right and a lot of things that could go wrong. And, you know, I think a lot of things really have to go right to get those next, you know, let's say 92 wins is where you got to be to make the playoffs. I think it's pretty much always been that way, you know, since they've expanded, and even with the wild card in the recent years. You know, 90 wins, 91, 92 is pretty much where you got to be comfortable for, you know, playoff spot or division or whatever. Ideally more, obviously. But I mean, those last six wins are pretty tough to get to, and I don't see that they made a lot of significant changes that really get them beyond that. I mean, one more pitcher, one more bat maybe could have been something. You know, you can't just count on the guys that they have to bust out. If they do, then good things will happen, but, you know, you've got to – you pretty much have to see Mike Moustakas has to be average or better. Escobar has to be close to average. Hosmer has to make the jump. Kane has to stay healthy. Aoki has to still be the guy that he is. Butler and Gordon have to have better years. And you're at this point, you're covering the whole diamond of guys who have to have either slight improvements or significant improvements. And in some cases, at least hold steady, and you can't always count on that. And that's not even looking at the pitching staff, where, you know, Guthrie's a question, Vargas, you know, a lot of people, myself included, are skeptical. So there's some stuff on paper. Yeah, it kind of looks like they could be okay. And then there's a lot of it's kind of shaky for me, I guess. And maybe I'm just shaken by, you know, the loss today that kind of makes me less confident right this moment in making the prediction. But I would say 86 is fair because the team's not largely that different. And like you said, you know, in the big departures and the big additions, you know, that's fairly similar, might balance out, you know, maybe with some variation of one or two wins here or there. So we'll see. I mean, it's, you know, right now, you know, it's one game in, and they've got a long ways to go to kind of reach where we expect them to be. So, you know, it's good to get these on the record now so we can point back to them later and laugh at each other.
And let's kind of leave with this. We've given our predictions. We gave Troy's. Well, somebody by the name of John Heyman made a prediction. I believe it was after our show last week, so that's why we didn't talk about it last week.
Oh, yeah.
But John Heyman predicted the Royals to have not only 92 wins, but to make it all the way to the World Series. Mike, what are your thoughts on this?
Well, that would be awesome. And, you know, if you look at it, I mean, you look at just last year. I mean, there are a couple of games that you could really say, okay, I want that one back. There's, you know, the game that Greg Holland blew against the Phillies where they had, you know, a big lead. There's opening day last year where Billy Butler was up with the bases loaded, didn't get anybody home. Royals lost 1-0. You know, there's the two games in Oakland, James Shields and Irvin Santana, both lost games 2-1, back-to-back. Right there, that's four games. I mean, that puts the Royals at 90 wins, just right there. And that's not counting, you know, just other games where maybe one more hit here or one better pitch here is going to be enough to get them there. So, I mean, there's a lot of those small things that can really impact, you know, a particular game, and then that particular game can go in and, you know, have an impact by the end of the year. And so, you know, maybe they do have some of that. You know, it just takes a little bit of luck in some of those games to kind of flip a few of them. So, I mean, I don't know, it's a tall order. I think I saw Peter Gammons also had Eric Hosmer coming in as a number three in AL MVP voting as one of his predictions. So, I mean, some people are high on him, and a lot of national writers are really high on the Royals. And you see a lot of kind of sideways glances and skepticism from actual Royals fans just because, you know, I think
that's all we know.
It's all we know. Yeah. I mean, it's just like, it's such a foreign idea to have a national writer be so high on guys. And some of it, and others have pointed this out before me, some of it is, you know, it's really easy to pick Detroit, you know, to be in there. It's really easy to pick the Rangers or anything like that. So, you know, Heyman picking the Royals, I mean, we're talking about him. So,
yeah,
you know,
now the one thing that I will agree with from his standpoint, at least from the standpoint of predicting the Royals to go to the World Series, and I've said it on this show before, if they can somehow get those, that one game here or there, and swing that into a playoff appearance, then I think once they get in there, they're a team that is primed to make a good run, because the supposed strength of the squad being the bullpen, bullpens are huge in the playoffs, because
You're not so much worried about saving your bullpen. You're not worried about how many innings the pitcher is. If somebody's being ineffective, you're going to end it. You're going to get them out of there. And you're going to go forward with whoever's best for that moment. And if the Royals have more offense than anybody else, then that puts them in a good position. So I do think if they can get there, then they have as good a shot as anybody. But it's getting there, that's the question.
Yeah, and it was the same thing last year. And the Royals are a great defensive team, and that does very well in the playoffs as well. You know, because those games, they aren't usually that high scoring most of the time. The weather is colder. You know, there's a lot more put towards, you know, finding the right matchups. And, you know, it's just, you know, lower scoring games. And that would seem to fit better with the Royals. So maybe if you put them in a lower run scoring environment, then I don't know, maybe they won't score any runs. So careful what you wish for. But I think you're right. You know, you would have a rotation potentially of Shields, let's say Ventura, maybe even Vargas, maybe Kyle Zimmer coming up. And, you know, you get some of those guys who are able to come in and give you six good innings, seven good innings, and go from there, you know, hand it off to the bullpen and Greg Holland. And that's a pretty good place to be, especially when, you know, you're operating on, you know, a series where, you know, like in the, you know, one game can really swing it pretty easily. You know, that could be a big advantage if the Royals can get there. But you're right, it's they got to get there.
Yeah, so with that, I think we'll leave you tonight, or I guess tonight, this morning, this afternoon, whenever you're listening to this podcast, because that's the magic of podcasting. But, yeah, so we kind of gave our predictions, and we're all three of us, speaking for Troy, are ready for another fantastic season, and that's not sarcastic, because last year actually was pretty awesome. So
it was really fun.
Yeah, ready for another fun season of Royals baseball, where they're competitive, and who knows, maybe they even finally take that leap for the first time in my lifetime and get to those playoffs. So speaking for Michael Engel and Troy Olson, we'll see you next time, and as always, go Royals.
You have been listening to a Royals Podcast Network presentation.
But I think when you look at this roster, there are a few inflection points, if you will. And time out. Can you hear my dogs?
Yeah, your dogs aren't happy for being put out.
Good Lord. Well, they're not outside. I don't know what my... They should be down with my girl fiance. I don't know what she's... Sorry, let me hold on. I'll be right back.
Okay. Hey. Quiet. I'm absolutely leaving this in for all you listeners at home. Maybe we'll make it an outtake.
All right, I'm back. Sorry about that.
Okay.
I don't know where Jackie went. But we'll just restart this one from my section.
Okay.